and remind you to silence your phones and any other electronic devices. The commission completes its work and makes all decisions in public. Our study session begins this morning at 10 a.m. with the business session beginning at 1 p.m. As always, the public may request to be placed on the agenda in advance, and at this time, no one has requested to be on the agenda. We welcome the public's input at our meetings, and since these meetings are recorded, if you wish to address any item on the agenda, we ask that when you come to the microphone, please speak with the microphone on the table over there or in front of the chairs. State your name and address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Today we have three commissioners president. Commissioners Congdon and Arsenal will be joining us by phone. Also attending is Steve, our manager Steve Wright, General Counsel Katie Young, and Clerk of the Board Rebecca Garfing. Please join me in the Pledge of Allegiance and Safety Minute led by Tiffany Davis.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Good morning. I actually have some slides that are not up. I'm going to talk to you about learning team facilitation training that took place at the district in early February. Again, I am Tiffany. I work in HR. I've been with the district for about 2.5 years or so. This is my why. I've been in Wenatchee for about 3 years. So when a grade contacted me and asked me to participate in the learning team facilitation training, I was intrigued. Prior to coming to the district, I worked in healthcare. I did quite a bit of work with Lean and Six Sigma tools, and so when he first brought it up to me, I was really curious about what a learning team is, how it might be different from a Kaizen event or a traditional root cause analysis, and I think with learning teams, it really starts with the goal. So the goal of a learning team is to learn enough that we realize that given the conditions, they, being the workers involved in the event that we're learning about, given the conditions that they faced and the information that they had, we would probably have made the same decision. So it's really people-centered, more so than process-centered. So these events typically bring together groups of employees that were involved in an event. Typically, it's an event or a close call where we've identified there is risk there, or we actually experienced risk. So you can also use learning teams for events that went really well. Maybe they went exceptionally well, and we want to learn more about why that happened. Usually it's a couple people directly involved in the work, some outside eyes, so one person that's not involved in the process, and then one to two facilitators. The sessions are broken into two parts. So the first part, there's two sessions. So the first session is discovery. That's all about the learning. We just ask questions, we listen, we try to really understand what happened during the event, and we don't come up with any solutions during that time. We are just learning during that time. The second session is where we do come up with solutions. That's improvement and solutions development. So what makes a learning team unique? How is it different than a Kaizen event or root cause analysis, one of those types of processes? So the first thing that's really important for employees to know if they participate in a learning event is that it is not an investigation. If we think that something occurred that was egregious, that was a total violation of a policy, we would not pursue a learning event. That would not be the appropriate course of action. So these events are intended to really look at the big picture of our processes, of the way that we do our work, of our culture, and how our culture might influence our work. They are not intended to place blame on employees that were involved in the event. We are not seeking one root cause. What I think really stands out about a learning event is that you're recognizing how complex the story of an event can be. Sometimes there are outside influences that might factor how employees are behaving at work. Sometimes there's sort of cultural norms that aren't spoken, but that before the event happened when we're kind of learning about how things took place. So we don't believe there is one root cause. We think probably multiple things led to an event occurring, and that's what we're learning about here. And again, another unique thing about the learning team is that we're really trying to empower the workers. Lots of process improvement methodology talk about respecting the worker, but one of the things we specifically hope to get out of a learning team is action that the learning team can implement in their own work groups towards improvement. So how will learning terms bring value to the district? Ideally, they're going to generate a heightened sense of ownership for the contributing factors that might lead to a positive or a negative event. When the team has this chance to really be together and think through all the things that led to an event, hopefully they're going to really feel a strong sense of owning those things and the plan for implementing improvements, because they're going to work together to identify potential improvements. Again, because learning teams really recognize the humanity of the workers and not just them as part of a process, it promotes respect and compassion for workers. We hope that when they leave a learning team, they are going to feel really understood, really listened to, really valued as an employee at the organization. And hopefully it's going to result in tangible action, something that they can actually do when they get back to their workplace to improve the processes. And so it's going to be hopefully really positive in the sense that they don't feel like they spent this time in this learning team, we listened to them during that time, and then nothing happens. Hopefully it's going to add value because they're actually going to see action occur. Another positive thing about the learning teams is that they're pretty fast, pretty efficient. I know when I used to participate in Kaizen events, sometimes those took many, many weeks to coordinate. There was a lot of resources involved. Learning teams are pretty quick. They're flexible. Usually they are two distinct sessions, but you can do them in one day if you have to. Ideally, you do kind of one session in the afternoon, one session the next morning. They only take 5 to 8 employees to conduct. You don't need any high-level resources. So it's a pretty effective tool, and so I'm excited about using it here at the district. I think that employees who participate will feel engaged. I suspect that as employees get the chance to participate, they will share their experience with others, and hopefully that will generate more teams being interested in doing it. And seeing all kinds of small process improvements going on throughout the district, but more importantly, I think a greater sense of ownership and empowerment for the work that we're all doing in our respective departments. So thank you.
Great.
Yeah, Tiffany, you used the phrase, I believe I got it right, the humanity of the team. That really added for me a significant piece understanding it from that perspective. So nice choice of words and getting your concept across. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tiffany, you know, I think the reality is that we all want to work in an organization where teams participate, they learn from each other, we put our heads together. And what you're talking about, that power of humanity, is that it just really makes a place that nobody really wants to go to work, but if we're going to go to work, let's have a great place to go to work too. And I just have one suggestion for you. Can you go back to your picture of your family? Now, if your husband had the only thing you could sell this picture. If he had a salmon in his arm, nestled, you know, just nestled with the salmon and held the baby up, you could sell that picture. Thank you very much, Tiffany.
Thank you. Tiffany, I just want to say thanks. You were quite poised, given that we didn't have your slides ready for you to go when you got started, but you did a great job.
Thank you very much.
Nice job.
Very nice job.
Commissioners, we have an agenda presented to us. Items on the consent agenda are subject to transfer at the request of board members. Do I hear any such requests or additions to the agenda?
I'd like to suggest we add agenda item 9 to the consent agenda for when we approve it later.
Okay.
Second.
Okay. Any other changes? Okay. We don't have to vote on that, but if we all have consensus on that, we'll move forward. So We are on item number 3, wholesale energy trading resolution update.
Yeah, I want to invite Jamie Mitchell and Mike Bradshaw to come up. We spent a fair amount of time, I'd say nearly a year, reviewing our wholesale trading policy. We want to provide some information to the board today. No action is required. And we'll describe the reasons why we think it's an appropriate time to be making these changes.
Hi, Jamie Mitchell. I'm a senior risk analyst in the risk management department. And my role is to provide independent oversight of the trading function here at the district.
And I'm Mike Bradshaw, and I'm the term power trader, and I work in the energy planning and trading group.
Okay, so why we're here today, as Steve mentioned, we've spent a lot of time looking at the wholesale energy trading resolution. So it's been some time since we've brought this to the board, so we're going to do a quick overview of that resolution. And then I'm going to turn it over to Mike, and he's going to talk about the reasons to update the resolution, some proposed resolution limits and language, and then we'll talk about summary and next steps. And again, like Steve mentioned, there's no action required today. It's just informational. So the current wholesale energy trading resolution was approved by the board in 2011, in November of 2011. So it's been some time since we've updated it. Updates are much needed. So this resolution, the commission delegates the authority to enter into wholesale energy transactions to the general manager and also provides some sideboards for which the trading should occur. Just for clarification, the resolution does not apply to our long-term cost-based contracts or any sales or purchases we would make on behalf of district's retail customers. And finally, per RCW, this resolution needs to be presented to the board at a meeting, and then there's a 10-day waiting period. So we will be back in 2 weeks for final to request final approval. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike to talk about the reasons why.
All right. So we've really narrowed it down to 3 primary reasons that we need to update the resolution. As Jamie mentioned, 2011 was the last update, and our business has really changed. Some of the products we trade and some of the reasons why we sell forward has changed, and so we want to make sure we update our resolution to capture that. Also, there is a lot of change in the energy market, and so we have more conservative limits than we currently have now. And then we also propose to allow more modeling flexibility. That would be delegated to the power risk management policy versus at the resolution level. And I'll go into each one of these a little bit more detail here. So the first one is our business has changed and the reasons why we trade forward has changed. And this really kind of comes about with the specified source sales. And that's the way that we can monetize our carbon-free energy. So historically, we've always sold energy typically in fixed price. And so when I say fixed price, that's like an agreed upon price that the buyer and the seller both have at the time that they transact. And that provides a fixed revenue stream to the district. However, now with specified source sales, and those are typically traded at an index price. When I say index, you can think of that as like a variable price. So you can kind of think of a fixed price as like a fixed interest rate on a mortgage, and a variable or an index sale would be more of like a variable interest rate. And so that's the way that specified source is traded just in the market. And so we wanted to make sure that we separated out the reasons that, or the two different purposes of those trades. And so index does not hedge price risk. When I say that, the price is not agreed to ahead of time. It's not known. So the purpose of it is not to lock in a fixed price or lock in a fixed revenue stream. It's really just to convey the carbon-free nature of our energy. And that's when to make sure that that's distinct and separate from the transactions that do actually mitigate price risk. But right now, they're all looked at the same time under one limit. And so we're proposing to separate that into 2 limits.
I just want to pause for a second. Some of you have noted that the graph that we show regularly at the quarterly reports, that there are periods in which we appear to have sold more than the roughly 1,100 megawatts that we have. And the reason for that is because we do have a sale that's an index price sale. So you don't want to sell more than what you have because you're exposed to market unless you have someone that's paying you the market price in return for that sale. And so that allows us to, at times, to sell above the amount of physical supply that we have. So this change really captures a concern that I think the board has wondered about at times, which is why is it that we sometimes have those kinds of sales? It's and in effect, what you'll be seeing in the future is a variety of different tests that we're using to make sure that we are within our trading limits to capture the fact that what we're trying to do is make sure that we are that the district's customer owners are not exposed to a shortfall where we would have to make up the difference at what could be a very high market price and not have a countervailing sale that will cover that cost.
Yeah. So the next reason is the uncertainty in the market. And so the grid is really changing. The resources that make up the supply are really changing. You've all heard about the renewable build-out of solar and wind, retirement of coal plants. And so there's a lot of uncertainty right now. So the proposed new limits are more conservative, and so they're more based on a stress water or a much below average water, just to ensure that we have enough energy and we're not exposed to potentially high prices and being short and having to buy at those prices. We've seen some price excursions October of 18, the natural gas pipeline had an explosion that really reduced natural gas flows and took a lot of natural gas generated offline. Prices responded. We had cold snaps February and March of last year, prices responded, so things are pretty tight. And so taking that into consideration, we have reduced our limits such that, again, we just retain more and that we won't be short and having to purchase at high price situation. And then the third, again, is just the modeling flexibility. Again, the current resolution limits the type of modeling approach. And a lot of times not one modeling approach fits all. And so this would just delegate the type of modeling to use to the Powers Management Committee. And so it relates to more of a removal of language that's existing. So to get into more of the proposed changes, so we have limits that apply to fixed price transactions only. Again, trying to monitor how much energy do we have exposed to either changing market prices. And then also a limit to capture our totality. And when I say that, I mean all of our contractual committed energy, irregardless if it's fixed price or index, just how much have we committed to serve as a combination. And then we have different limits within those to apply to forward years where you have kind of no information about the types of load besides our current load forecast or water supply. We don't know what next year's bringing, but within the current year, we start to get more information, how our load's shaping up, what kind of water supply do we have? What kind of snowpack in the mountains do we have? And so the limits are adjusted for the current year to accommodate that knowledge. And so the proposed language would be to limit fixed price sales in an amount that's equal to the generation that's available under a stress water. When I say stress water, that's equivalent roughly to about a 1 in 20 year. So about a 5% chance of that actually happening. But it's being conservative and making sure that even under that situation that we're covered. And the current year and the beyond the current year, those two underlying terms, they're essentially the same things, the same idea, same concept rolling through, looking out multiple years as well as looking within the current year, always maintaining enough energy on hand to cover a very bad water year. And this kind of puts some numbers to that. And I can kind of walk through this here. So the current is kind of broken up into two sections. The top box is our current resolution. And if we were sold to the maximum limit in 2021, under average water, we'd have 30 average megawatts of length. That would be our expectation to be surplus. And under stress water, we'd be 22 average megawatts short. And so you can see if you had high prices, and I use $300 here, which is equivalent to 2001 prices. So a very extreme case here. But what that would do would be a shortfall, and the district would be purchasing 22 average megawatts at $300, which would result in about $57.8 million purchase. So that's really what we're trying to hedge against, change these limits so that does not happen. And so down below is the proposed limits, and you can see how that changes. And under stressed water, you'd be flat, essentially flat, because the maximum limit would not allow sales above fixed price sales above zero. And so you would not be in the market purchasing, so you would have no impact from high prices. But there is an offsetting impact here. When you are trying to hedge against a very infrequent but potentially very bad outcome, you will have more uncertainty in your forecast. And so essentially, if you're not selling as much forward in a fixed price, then you will have that energy that's not sold forward in a fixed price exposed to market. And that chance of that 1 in 20 water year and those high prices isn't too frequent. There's more often the case you're going to have more energy exposed to changing prices.
To a downside risk.
Yeah, so it introduces a little bit more volatility, more uncertainty into your forecast. And so this graph here is trying to illustrate that here. And so this is the range of revenue forecast by year. And this is as if we were sold to the maximum limit under our current policy and under the proposed. So the gray bars, you can see, and just maybe looking at 2025 to isolate 1 year here, you can see the range is on the bottom side, 78 million, top side is 121 million. The proposed limits would not have as much sold forward in a fixed price to get to the maximum limit. Therefore, you have more energy exposed to changing market prices. So your range grows. So now your downside is 72 million, and your upside is even higher, 135. Again, prices go up, prices go down. So it's really the trade-off. We understand there'll be more revenue uncertainty, but the benefit it brings by hedging against that severe downside, although infrequent, it's a pretty big number. So that's kind of the trade-offs there.
So I want to bring this back for a second to conversations we've had with the board in the past. Notice that this is the traditional way of doing the analysis, a 90-10 forecast, 90% and 10% forecast. And what Mike described on the previous page was a 95% forecast. So it's operating outside of the traditional range that we've been looking at. So why would we do that? Fundamentally, it's just because we are being heavily influenced by the fact that we see this regional supply-demand picture, which has changed so dramatically in the last couple of years. And we're seeing a lot higher likelihood of shortages in the region than what we have historically been willing to accept from a regional planning standpoint, particularly as you look out to 2025, which is now within our planning period. So we're responding to the fact that it appears that the region around us looks like it's short, and if there was a bad water year, it could be very, very expensive. So this policy, I would say, is applicable to the conditions that we are experiencing today. It may be that 4 or 5 years from now we would rethink this and do it differently. But based on what we know and the fact that that the region is moving into this period of deficit, it seems like it's a time to get more conservative with respect to marketing to reduce the exposure of that potential big purchase if we had oversold.
When does the real restriction on natural gas begin in the new Washington scenario?
Probably not until, first of all, the requirements don't come into play until 2030,
right.
Other than the commitments to eliminate the use of the coal plants, which comes in 2025. So you then begin to wonder about how you would meet how the state will be able to accomplish the 80% target in 2030, which is mandatory, and then the 100% target, which is only advisory at this point for 2045. So we don't really know how that will play out. And we felt comfortable supporting that bill because it opened the door to new technology coming along and being able to solve the problem. And it's not here yet, right. So there is a bet on the come. But that's, I think, the reason why there's a difference between the mandatory requirement and the advisory guidance and the 15-year time frame in between.
Is it fair to say that last year's shortage was probably caused by a perfect storm of events, one being the pipeline problem coming in from Canada at that moment in time?
Yeah. Yes, although I'm a little bit hesitant about the term perfect storm because it suggests that it's a potentially a very rare event. And we basically are operating, I'd say, a bit more fragile power system in the Northwest these days than we have in the past, which is more susceptible to those kinds of events than what we would traditionally have expected.
Steve, I have a question with respect to if we're creating this buffer, what happens, can you draw from your picture, of what happens, let's say, in 2025 if we have an abundant water year and then we find ourselves with significant energy? What happens there?
So that's the scenario that's identified on the right-hand side that shows the lower revenues that we would receive. So in the 90% forecast, we'd see greater volatility than what we would have otherwise seen. It's about a $6 million impact. So, you know, you do accept the fact that if you have low water conditions, there will be greater risk to the district's revenue. So the trade-off here is that increased volatility, and you can really see it in Mike's numbers on the graph in 2025, that range, that we could have higher or lower revenues as a result of not selling forward today. But what you don't see on this one, but you saw in the previous graph, is if you went to a 95% forecast, you've got the exposure of a $58 million reduction compared against the current strategy. So again, this is protecting against that very low probability but high consequence event that could occur. And I very much doubt that we would have made this recommendation to make this change if it wasn't for the changing regional power supply situation. It's the exposure that's out there that in 1999 and 2000, the region was forecasting about a 20% loss of load probability, which was extraordinary because normally we don't want to be above 5%. And then we had a very low water condition in 2001, and it was very expensive. In this case, we're forecasting a 25% or above loss of load probability for 2025 and beyond, so higher than what we were forecasting in 1999 and 2000. And if we get good water conditions, it probably won't matter. And if we get really bad water conditions, the whole region's going to be paying attention to that.
So now we're going to kind of switch gears here. So that we talked a lot about fixed price and capping our exposure to prices and buying in the high market. So now we're going to talk more about the combined limit that covers both fixed price and index price. You can kind of disregard the kind of pricing it is. It's just how much physical commitment have we made, contractual commitments have we made. That covers both. And so what the proposal is, is that it's the same for the within the year. It'd be based off of stress water. Both limits are based off stress water. And for within the year, it would be the exact same limit as the fixed price limit. Again, looking at stress water. For terms beyond the current year, the future years, the proposal is to sell the ability to sell an additional 175 average megawatts. And the reason it's a different limit is because, again, we sell, the market typically transacts specified source carbon-free energy at an index price. That's just the function of the market and what the market prefers. And so by doing this, this would allow us to sell forward up to 175 average megawatts at index price. That's the key term there, for the purposes of monetizing our carbon-free energy. And this gets back to what Steve mentioned earlier, the graph that has always had a footnote that says we're above the limit because of index price trades. This would solve that problem, and so that would no longer be outside of the new limits.
So that kind of segues into our next slide. In the Energy Resources Quarterly Updates, you're used to seeing the graph on the left, which is how our current resolution has our transactions. They're all in one combined bucket with max and minimum hedge limits per our power risk management policy. So you're used to seeing everything all in one, regardless if they're fixed price transactions or index price transactions. So that's the graph on the left-hand side. This is the exact same look that was in the Energy Resources Q4 board presentation. So what we're proposing to move to is two different graphs, one for fixed price transactions with a fixed price limit. And then the other graph is the limit for fixed price and index price transactions combined. So as Mike was just discussing, the combined fixed price and index price graph shows an additional 175 megawatts of length above, basically, if you look at the line on the left, the fixed price limit, you have 175 above that line to be able to transact at index price. So currently, the light green little bars are what we've transacted, and then the shaded parts are what we'd have the ability to transact all the way up to that top maximum line. So as Steve mentioned, you guys have talked about why are we above the max in the current resolution, and that's because we do have those index trades. So in the new resolution, the proposed resolution, on a fixed price basis, we would not be above our max. And then in our fixed price and index price, we would have that room to go ahead and transact those index transactions all the way up until that maximum line.
And if I could add to that just a little bit, notice that on the fixed price that the total amount declines because it's now based on stressed water versus average water. Mm-hmm. So it's now at the 900 megawatt level instead of the 1100 megawatt level, which is the difference between a stressed water condition and an average water condition. So so the fixed price is limited to stressed water sale, and that means that we would have this additional amount, the variable stream flow that shows up above stressed water that would be available for sale within the year. And that's what creates the increased volatility.
A question I have is the 1,100 megawatts. Is that calculating what we have offline now, what will be coming back online, and what will be going back offline again as we continue to do the upgrades and repairs?
Okay, that was a really sophisticated question.
yeah.
You guys want to talk about how we're trying to capture all the things that are going on?
Yeah, when we model this, we do include all of our expectations of unit outage schedules.
Okay.
Whatever's available is modeled as.
So it's just kind of the average production over the next 5 years, what's going offline, what's coming online.
Yeah, and we do it.
Balancing that out.
Right, and we do it by month and different time periods, and we aggregate it up to these annual numbers. So it's pretty detailed.
Okay. Because I was looking at that yesterday and just thinking, I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Any other questions on those graphs? Okay.
I just have a question. As I'm looking at the graph of the current resolution and how we're selling the power, both the long-term cost plus and the market-based slices fine. Now, is that reflecting in the available to sell at fixed price on the right, which is fixed price plus index pricing, that gray box, which is now 159 megawatts looks like in 2025. Is that where the market based slice and the market and the long term contract price slicing is reflected? Yeah, I didn't ask that question very well.
Actually, the biggest problem was that you're not coming through quite as clearly as we would like, and I'm just going to check with Jamie and Mike. Did you understand the question?
I didn't get it fully.
I think I might have understood it. Are you asking if that 159 that is currently available right now for fixed price, if that will be where our market slices will show up? Like that'll be replaced with the green, or I'm sorry, the light blue?
Yes, the answer is that is correct. Both light blue and dark blue, is that reflected in the 159 megawatts in 2025 in the fixed price and index price?
Got it. Okay. So I think, let me try, because I think that, Jamie, you got it there. It won't be the dark blue, because the dark blue are the cost-plus contracts, and those are fixed. But the light blue would be slice contracts that would expand through time. Mm-hmm. So these are just the slice contracts we have in place as of this point. We are not adding to the slice contracts this year. We would expect in future years to offer slice contracts just as we have in the past, where we'd be offering the 5% slice on an annual basis, and then that will fill in the gray as we make those sales.
Right.
Did we get the question right, Commissioner Arso?
Yes, I think if I understand correctly, the gray box will shrink and the light blue box will expand as time goes by.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
And that reflects our standard way of doing business, that we offer the slice sales on an annual basis. Just as a reminder, we're not doing it this year because we put the 10-year sale to Avista in place a couple years ago that starts next year. So we just have already, in effect, made the slice sale for this year.
I guess my next question would be, there's always safety in the cost-plus contract. And according to the graph, the size of those contracts are tiny based on the proposed resolution. Can you go into a little bit of more detail on that? Is that where the index price is coming from?
Can you rephrase that one more time, Commissioner?
Okay, sorry. I have a little background noise. I apologize for that. So there's certain value in the cost-plus contracts in terms of protection and against risk. And with that box getting, or with that dark blue getting smaller, I guess my question is, where's that power going? Where the projection under the current resolution is 575 megawatts in 2025. And if you look at 2025 under the proposed fixed price plus index price, it's 461.
Oh.
We see. Okay, we understand what you're saying now. The graph on the left is assuming average water conditions. So since those long-term contracts are slice-based, the volume under average water is different than when you look at the graph, the two graphs on the right, because it's a stress water look. That volume decreases because they are a slice of our system.
Yeah, so the key, let me add to that and just say that the cost plus contracts are not changing during the period that we're looking at here through 2025. This is just a different look at how much energy is produced on the system under stress water versus average water. But the question you're asking is an important one, because what we can't see here is what happens after 2027 when the Alcoa contract is scheduled to end. And that is a subject of a specific issue in the 2020 District Performance Plan, where we want to begin to have a conversation with the board about how we should position for who we want to do with the energy that would become available under that contract post-2027.
Good answer. Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Any other questions before we move on?
Yeah. And I think it's the last one.
Okay.
So index sales, does that include the green premium, or is the green premium in addition to what the index sale is?
Yeah, so typically it's an adder to that. So the energy price is index unknown, okay. But then you tack on an adder, a fixed price adder,
$5. Is that reflected in the graphs?
The graphs are all average megawatt base, so there's no financial component to the energy based.
I think your question gets to an important point, though. One of the reasons that we enter into index price sales is it's an opportunity for us to be able to sell environmental attributes.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was underlying our thinking about this was always making sure that we had an adequate supply in our system to assure that hydropower was being used to serve Chelan County retail loads. So there is a piece of this that's also part of a philosophy that we think we've heard pretty clearly from the board, that we want to make sure that we're using hydropower to serve all loads at retail loads in Chelan County.
Anything else?
No.
Okay, shifting gears a little bit again, just to go over the third reason why we're updating the resolution is to address the proposed modeling. So currently the resolution calls out probabilistic modeling, and that's what we're required to use for everything. And the proposed resolution will allow for flexibility to have the Power Management Committee determine modeling methods. So it gives us, like Mike said, one modeling technique doesn't always fit all, so it'll give us the flexibility to use the most appropriate one.
So does the RCW compel us to spell out our modeling?
No.
No, this is an internal choice.
Yes.
Okay.
The RCW is just, and that kind of segues into our next step. So as we discussed, we're introducing the energy trading resolution today. The RCW is what requires us to have that 10-day waiting period. So we will be back at the March 16th board meeting to answer any questions and then ask for approval on that resolution. And just a summary of what we've discussed today. So really, this proposed resolution does address our current market environment conditions. So it separates the fixed price from the index price transactions, recognizing how they are different, provides for more conservative limits, mitigating the risk of purchasing in that high price environment that we showed, and then allows for the modeling choice to be made at the Power Risk Management Committee level. So at this time, we'd like to answer any other questions you might have.
Well, I guess I'd like to thank you for providing multiple hours of entertainment over the weekend. Trying to get some kind of a grasp on this from the layman's perspective. So thank you.
Yes, it is can be a very challenging topic. Well, we understand.
Yeah, just like, really? Yeah, I don't know what I just read. Let's read it again.
Commissioners on the phone, any other further questions? Hearing none, thank you very much. Very informative.
Yeah,
we'll see you on the 17th.
I just want to say thanks, Commissioner. I know this is a very technically complex matter. We've spent an awful lot of hours internally talking about this, trying to get this right, and appreciate your hanging in there with us on this. I think it's important.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yes.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Very much.
Next up, we want to talk about a very related subject, which is the Northwest Resource Adequacy Program. Greg Carrington has taken a real leadership role in the region in helping to formulate the resource adequacy standard, and he's here to provide an update. This, is, of course, gets to that fundamental issue of the supply-demand problem in the Northwest.
Thank you. So Greg Carrington, Managing Director of Energy Resources, and you heard throughout the last presentation, and Steve, we're expecting that the region as a whole will be short on energy or capacity starting as early as this year. So this presentation is to say, what is the region doing about that, and what are we getting together? So we've been getting together since last July to talk about this issue that's coming up. We conducted a study, and we're working on developing the IRA program, and you heard other presenters and Steve talk about the reason that we're capacity short is really for three reasons. One is the shutdown and the retirement of coal plants. The second reason that the region's going to be short on energy and capacity is because of the hesitancy of building natural gas plants in the future and the expectation that they may only operate 3 or 10% of the time. And the third reason we're short is because we're shipping a lot of our energy into California because they have they have the rules associated with renewable build-out that is causing them to be short. So the combination of all of those things is the reasons why we're looking at that. I'll explain more about what the resource adequacy program is. And this is the first update. As we make further progress, I'll be back again when the timing is right. Steve is part of the executive committee associated with the RA program at the Northwest Power Pool. I am part of the steering committee. The steering committee is the one that are developing the new rules and the governance and all of the things necessary for moving forward. And ultimately, Steve and the other CEOs around the region will be approving that if we decide to move forward at all. So I want to talk about how we got here. I want to talk about what we're doing about it. I want to also say what are we trying to accomplish on the goals and objectives, and then give you an overview about what you can expect to see in the future. So this was taken from a public webinar that I was a presenter at, and it occurred on February 7th. I'm not going through all of the slides. We originally started out with a presentation to a stakeholder advisory group that was 4 hours, And then we went to a public webinar that was 1.5 hours, and you're getting the 10-minute version of the presentation. So it's going to be a very quick run-through. I'm only presenting like 10 of the slides, and the rest of them I put in the appendix. So if you want to go and look in the appendix, you're welcome to go in there, ask me any questions you have about that in the future as well.
I'm already liking this.
The shortness of it?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I could do the four-hour version, but Steve, yeah, okay.
That's okay.
Okay, so first of all, the Northwest Power Pool. I don't know if you know much about the Northwest Power Pool. I think it was formed in the 1940s, and it was in response to a lot of the things that were going on at that time. And it's a voluntary organization. We have a contingency reserve sharing group, and there are right now about 34 members that you can see on this list that are part of the Northwest Power Pool. And that's the reason we did that, is because we had a place where we could go to where all the members were together, and they have an organizational structure of some sort today. When we heard about the resource adequacy program and some of the issues associated with whether we're going to have load resource balance in the future, the first thing we did starting in July of last year is we did a literature review of all of the studies that are out there. We took a look at other resource adequacy programs throughout the U.S., and we pulled everything together in what's called the Exploring a Resource Adequacy Program for the Northwest, and it came out in October of 2019. And then on October 1st of 2019, we had a symposium where all of the utilities got together. And basically, the conclusion of the report are that the region is going to have shortages as early as next year. Now, remember, this was 2019. So that we came to that conclusion. So that means we could be short on capacity and energy starting this year. And then Steve alluded to the fact by the time we get to the mid-2020s, we could be thousands of megawatts short in our region if we don't do something about it. And that's what this program is set up to do. As a result of this, we got together and reached out to all of the Northwest Power Pool members, 18 of the largest utilities, agreed to start looking at the design of a resource adequacy program. You can see the 18 are listed here on the ones that are funding this. We're one of those. We're part of the steering committee to do that. And then, how is it going to function? So the resource adequacy program is set up. If you have the need to balance out the resources that are in the region, and you're going to be looking at the peak loads that you're expecting, and you want to make sure, in order to have a resource adequacy program, that the resources you have meet the peak loads in the future. And you typically want to look out 1 to 3 years, because if you need a new resource, if you have to build a gas peaker, or if you have to build other resources, it generally will take you 1 to 3 years in order to build a new resource in the area. And it's kind of like the intersection point. We do integrated resource planning that looks 10 years out, and we do planning at the current year, which is more doing operating reserves. And this is going to fill the void in between what we do in the current year and what we do in our integrated resource planning. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that you can look together as a whole, and the peak load of the region is going to be less together, and you'll be able to share resources. And, you know, like if we added up all our individual peak loads, you end up with a much higher peak load. If you look at it together, it lowers that. And what you can do is you can share the resources and lower your overall peak by sharing the resources. So the coincidental peak that would occur by looking at it all individually, comparing it to what you do as a whole, you'll be able to then, like if somebody in, an example would be somebody in Montana may have a peak that occurs at a different time that we do. So if they have resources and capacity in Montana, we can help share those resources in something that we would need in Washington State. That's an example. Another part of this is making sure that we respect the local autonomy. So the rules associated with this, even though they're going to be voluntary, it's going to be something that we're going to be able to respect, basically the rules that we develop as part of our program, but also as the state PUCs develop those rules as well. And then finally, the last point I wanted to make here is that it's going to be voluntary to join. But once you join it, you're going to be part of the program, and you're going to have to stick to the rules that you agree to as well.
Okay, so this is my part of the presentation right here, and it's mostly talking about what the timing is and what the rules are going to be. So as you can see here, the first phase of the program occurred last year and ended in October when we had the finding report. We are in what we call phase 2A, which is the preliminary design phase of this. We expect that we'll be done with the preliminary design by June of this year. We're going to go back to the executives, and we're going to say, here's what we recommend for governance. Here's what we recommend for the rules. Here's how much it's going to cost. And we are going to ask for basically approval to go into the final design of an RA program. And that we expect that the final design of the program will be completed by the end of this year. If we then decide to go on to the next phase, which is called the implementation phase, that's getting all the computer systems in place and setting it up, we expect that that would, phase three, the implementation would occur throughout 2021, and that we would be able to start testing the program as early as 2022. Okay? Any questions so far?
Yeah. I was just scanning back over the slides, and a question that emerged to me. It was based on once the program will be voluntary to join, but once you join, you're contractually committed. And I was looking back, and you've got two different lists of members. You have funding members and Northwest Power Pool members. Is there a difference there, or are there a few?
Yeah, so there's 34 members that are the Northwest Power Pool, and there are 18 members that are the funding members. And the way that I look at it is the funding members are going to be most of the entities that will be responsible for compliance in the future, whereas there's other members that may not care so much about it because they might not be responsible for compliance, or they may be outside of the Northwest. For example, there are some entities that are from California, and since we're developing an RA program for the Northwest, it's unlikely that the California entities would want to fund something that we're doing in the Northwest. It could affect them, though, because if we're developing a capacity energy program for the Northwest, the amount of energy that could go down to California would be affected by that as well.
And you do have a couple of California members on the funding side. So.
Yeah, they're in there right now, but I think that in the future they probably won't be there. Some of the key design elements to pay attention to is the first bullet up here is who's going to be running the program and what will the governance structure be. The second bullet is what will the rules of the program be, and these are the things that we're working on right now. The third bullet is, like, who should be involved? What input should we get, like the state PUCs? Should we reach out to FERC? You know, should we reach out to other entities as well? And then finally, what's the plan for move? When will we begin? When will we be able to be ready to be able to share resources across the region? We want to, what are our goals associated with this? We want to design a program that allows us to continue to operate safely, efficiently, and reliably. We want to deliver investment savings through diversity of benefits. I mentioned to you before, if we can reduce the peak load by sharing, that means one entity may not need to go out there and buy or build a 400-megawatt plant, as an example. We want to be able to respect the different jurisdictions throughout the states, including the FERC jurisdiction, state PUCs, and local boards like this one. We want to design a program that is acceptable within the current and evolving regulations, so we need to be adaptable as the regulations change. We want to be able to respect states' rights to influence carbon regulation, as an example, and be able to design the program to be able to adjust to that. We want to design a program that is technology neutral. We don't want to have a preference for wind, solar, hydro. We want to do what's the least cost for our customers in the region. And we want a program that is well-defined, voluntary, and we want to make sure that it's accurately tracked. So we want to make sure that the rules are easily repeatable and transferable from each entity that's trying to comply with the rules and the regulations. We want to design a program that can be extended to other regions in the West. We are not the only ones that are experiencing resource adequacy problems. The Desert Southwest, as an example, has expressed desire to join forces with us. California is in the middle of designing their resource adequacy program. They just got done issuing a findings report that's almost the same as us, coming to the same conclusion. We want to make sure that anybody that does join the resource adequacy program, we understand what the rules are, and each entity is going to pay the same amount and is going to receive the benefits associated with that as well. And then finally, we want to make sure that we send efficient long-term investment signals. If we set up the rules, then entities that are resource short can use those rules to justify the reasons why they need to go out there and build resources. And finally, we want to make sure we have a process so that you can exit or enter the program as need be, because it's going to be voluntary. Okay, so what's next? We are going to be meeting with the industry experts. So we have taken a look at how CalISO and SPP and other regions are doing that. We're bringing them in, and we'll be talking to them about that. We'll be developing the organizational structure to house the resource adequacy program. We have to do more modeling. If we design a program, we need to make sure that it's efficient and effective and going to be able to do the things that we want it to do. We're looking to incorporate feedback that we get along the way, and we're getting prepped right now for what I call phase 2B, which would be the final design phase. So what does this all mean for Chelan PUD? In the end, the first thing to remember is that we're in really good shape at being able to serve our load, right? There are times where we do make market purchases, particularly when, like Grand Coulee, could change flows by up to plus or minus 40% from time to time. But overall, the PUD serves our load, and we have a dependable supply of electricity, so we're in good shape. But it may mean that in the future we have to pay, we have to become even more conservative. We just got done presenting to you the changes that we're proposing in the resource, the risk mitigation, rules. We may come back to you and say, in order for us to meet the peak lows in the future, we need to be even more conservative. Or we could come back and say, rather than holding that for our own peak load, we may go out there and purchase something that when we know that there is a peak load requirement that's going to come up. And most of the peak loads occur over a 4-hour, a 6-hour, or an 8-hour time period. So do you hold, the maximum amount for the entire time period, or do you go out there and buy a call option that can serve your peak load for that 4 hours? Those are the sorts of things that we still need to evaluate, and that we plan on doing that. So with that, wanted to see any questions you have about the program itself. Steve, is there anything you want to add?
I would like to add two things. One, Greg is leading what is the key team in this in terms of designing the program. And so he's put a lot of time into this. Really appreciate the amount of time he spent flying back and forth to Portland. And I think for a good reason. It's important to us. So we could do well, potentially, in a market that has a lot of chaos. But it would be very different from our business model. It would be a market in which you'd have very low prices interspersed with very high prices, a lot of volatility in the market. And generally, that's not the way we like to operate. We like to find more stability. And I would say it's not in the interest of regional consumers as well. So we're trying to push for getting to something that will cause resources to be built to bring supply and demand into balance in the region. And in doing that, it creates a price for capacity. And we obviously are a capacity seller. So it's a more stable source of revenue than what we would see in a market in which we didn't have resource adequacy standards.
And whenever there's chaos in the market and there's not enough energy to go around, it seems like every time that there's an outage somewhere, it's always followed by a new set of rules as well. So to the extent that we can help stabilize kind of the way that energy is traded and be able to share resources with other entities that may be looking for the resources, the more we protect our customers, we protect the customers throughout the Northwest,
And stability means that we'll be able to be in control of our own destiny without having a whole bunch of new rules and regulations associated with that as well. So it's important from that perspective.
So, Greg, you just highlighted a key issue that always is in the back of my brain. As I look at the wall, the best for the most for the longest, the key reason for us to be deeply involved in this is to stability provides for a lot less regulation over time.
That's right.
That's a key element.
Yep. So
thank you for highlighting.
Yeah, so I knew somebody that in their office, they had in their office a diagram that went all the way around their office, and it said it had an event and a regulation, an event and a regulation, an event, and it went all the way around their office. And you can go back to every single regulation, and it was caused because exactly that. And that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Just like to, oh.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, this just brings up all kinds of questions. But have states that have contrived, what I call contrived carbon standards, in order to deal with the resource inadequacy, they could adjust those standards and create the opportunity for more resource adequacy. But doubtful, but they could.
Yeah, so I think what you're alluding to, this is a result of the unintended consequences of thinking through some of the regulations that are currently out there, right? So
essentially, yeah.
Right? And so there are some states, like California, that have backtracked a little bit on closing some of the gas peakers that they have in California, because they understand now that they're doing the math about what this is leading up to and the capacity shortfall, they're saying, let's put a pause on the closure of some of the gas peakers that are down there.
And the other question that kind of has just been rattling around is, if you can run a gas plant limited to 3 to 8% of the market time, why would you invest?
Yeah, so that's a huge issue. That's right. And so there could be a time, you know, if there's an overbuild of the wind and solar, and you run into a situation where a gas peaker can only operate 3 to 10% of the time, this may provide the support for somebody to go out there and build it and get paid for it as well. So that's really what part of this is, you know, because right now, it's really hard to get a bank to invest in something that's going to operate 3% of the time, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And my guess is, between regulations and the potential of brownouts, maybe there will be a reality adjustment in terms of production.
Right.
So we hope that this will lead to that. You know, if you have a resource adequacy standard, you're sending a clear signal as to which load-serving entities are short and therefore need to take action of some kind. And the challenge is, the resource adequacy standard just says, here's the standard and a penalty associated with that. It doesn't get you to the build decision. It doesn't get you to the permitting that's necessary, but hopefully it sends the right signal to the entities that can provide the permits that this is important.
Yeah.
Just for one other thought, I heard a student of the history of the Northwest Power Pool recently say something that I thought was really insightful. He said, you know, we created the power pool actually to try to figure out, because we had this hydro system, and we were trying to figure out how to operate the hydro system so it could meet load. And then we added thermal plants along the way in kind of an incremental way, and we figured out how to operate to meet load. And now we have this really dramatic change in our power supply. And basically the role of the power pool now is to figure out, so how are we going to take this power supply that we've got, and how do we meet load with it? And when you think about it that way, it makes sense for the power pool to be the entity to pull this together. It really does fit with their history of what they do.
Okay. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
Okay, next up, we're ready for our regular report on the 2020 legislative session. Tracy and Sean will be presenting.
Good morning. Tracy Ent, Director of External Affairs.
Sean Seaman with External Affairs.
Oh. So, Today we're going to do a session update. I'm going to cover, and we can have a discussion about the, what are we calling it now, the oil-free, the self-lubricating oil technology that we've been talking about, legislation on that. Let me see here. So before we get into the specifics of the legislation and the number of bills that Sean has to go through, a couple of key cutoff dates, today being one. In fact, I'm getting updates for the hearing as we speak. And then we have a March 6th cutoff date and legislative session wrapping up on March 12th. So we have the non-oil turbine hub research and development. Sean's going to go over some other energy legislation as well as some HR and other items. Wanted to pause on this because even just a couple minutes ago, some of this is changing. The state budget projections. At the end of the last session, it was about $1.5 billion projected. Then at the beginning of this session, that was reduced to about $600 million. $300 million of that was from an estate tax from a very rich person's death last year. And then I just got word that Department of Health has requested $100 million in preparation for the coronavirus. So the projections could have an impact that trickles down into some of our interests, and that's something that's being dealt with right now.
So you're saying the surplus dropped that much in a year's time?
Yeah.
Our economy cooled off?
Well, and it doesn't include Boeing. This doesn't include the projected, 200. Yeah. So, but those are the numbers that we're seeing. So you recall there were two bills in play related to the same subject, Representative Gaynor's bill 2825. I say here the fiscal note was included, but what we actually heard was is that the bill 2825 was included in the assumed House bill list. So the budget folks have a list, and they're working as if this bill is funded. Passed out of finance. And it's now on to the House floor calendar. So it's through rules, and it's sitting there, and it's not subject to cutoff. So it's sitting there pending potential action. Most of the work has been around Senate Bill 6012. As you recall, it passed out of the Senate 39-9. It does have a fiscal note called out specifically. And the dates on the scheduled exec are wrong. It was actually last Friday. It was scheduled, did not make it, and so we're getting updates today. It's they just got back out of their caucus moments ago, and it's scheduled to move through with a Stryker amendment that we can go over a little bit today.
The Stryker amendment's already been added to it?
Yeah.
So it's not the same language when it came out of the Senate?
That's right.
Okay.
So over the last couple of weeks, there was quite a bit of input related to the, I'll say the second version of 6012. You remember last year, the first version was largely called a tax parity bill. That was met with not a great deal of interest. So it was revised earlier this session, largely based on the Gaynor bill, which we were calling oil-free. So essentially the Gaynor bill language was incorporated into 6012, and the prior 6012 language was removed. Then we heard from a number of utilities concerns about proceeding with the what we were calling the oil-free language would reduce the chance for future hydro legislation benefiting others, because this was largely going to be a benefit to utilities that were willing to install this new technology and test the new technology. There were concerns about the concept or the idea that this is highlighting that oil is used in turbines, and that could be bad for the hydro industry. There was also a concern that by investing in and perhaps perfecting oil-free turbine technology, that it could create another category for marketing of hydropower. And the last bullet, this is actually our preference as well. We prefer the broader tax parity bill from last session, but we were told that that would not pass this session. So based on a number of discussions and input and some leaning in by Tacoma, they've convened a utility work group that has crafted the next evolution of 6012, which essentially adds a criteria of investing in turbines to increase efficiency and help support the transition to more clean energy in the state of Washington. So it adds that to the definition of a qualifying investment. It also caps the fiscal note at essentially $2.5 million a year, or $5 million per biennium. And then it adds a element that each utility would essentially have a commensurate opportunity to seek the remittance. So if you have a lot of generation capability, then you would be eligible for more, and it's proportional to your generation capability. If you look at the roughly 18 utilities that have generation in Washington, there's about 8,000 megawatts of generation, and so we have about 2,000 megawatts of generation, and then each utility has a percentage of that total, and then each utility would be eligible for that percentage of the remittance. So it's $2.5 million a year. What's your percentage of the total generation? And that's what you would be eligible for. Goes all the way from about 23% down to less than 1% per utility. This concept is being worked heavily. It seems to be garnering some good support, the PUD Association members, initial discussions with key legislative members. I think there's still more work happening there. We don't have confirmation that this is a concept that will satisfy the criteria of incremental value sought out with the cost to the state's budget. But that's it appears that that is heading, or that we're getting some good feedback. We've contributed to discussions with the utilities, trying to prepare language, which has now been prepared and offered. We've also signed on to a letter from 10 utilities, or we've lent our letterhead. That basically urges the legislators to consider this new striking amendment. And of note on there, which is good, it includes Avista, Seattle City Light, Lewis, Cowlitz, Douglas, Grant, Snohomish, Chelan. So a good cross-section of utilities that have shown a lot of interest are supporting this proposed change, and they're literally voting right now, and Dave is giving me updates. So if I procrastinate long enough, or if Sean's actually watching it, we'll be able to give you an update. So it's happening real time. There's a lot of work still to do, a lot of opportunities for things to go sideways. I will say that this $100 million request for coronavirus at the state level could change the budget outlook. We just don't know. That's literally just happened the last few moments. The good news is I think the utility industry is coalescing around an idea. Now we need to verify that it meets or satisfies some of the legislators' interests, and we'll see how that moves forward in the coming moments.
Let me just add a couple of things to that. So compared against hydro tax parity, the self-lubricating legislation only spent about half as much money from the state budget. But almost all of that was assumed to go to Chelan. So what this version does is it increases some, but not up to the prior level, the amount of funding that would be available to utilities, and then shares that amongst the utilities. And so compared against either of the earlier versions of the bill, Chelan would get less than what was anticipated there. I'd say a little bit, around half, maybe a little bit more than half, something like that. But obviously it creates more harmony in the hydropower family. And so that's why we've been supportive. We were frustrated that we weren't getting to where we needed to get to, and it looked like nothing was going to pass. And so this has now led us to a place where we have an opportunity potentially to get something where there can be a broad benefit across the hydropower industry.
I think one of the things that's really helped is the other utilities stepping in and engaging on this. We really searched for some diverse legislative engagement last year, and for different reasons it didn't happen just in the last week. That's changed, and I think that's garnering some more input from other legislators. When the other utilities across the state have leaned in, it's got more people interested. And so that's been very positive. And as an aside, the Chapman Amendment, which is the amendment we're talking about, did pass. It passed, but now I'll just be quiet because it's on hold till Wednesday. So something is going on. But anyway, that involvement by the other utilities has really been helpful. Any other?
Thank you.
John, I'm going to get an update here.
Well, I'll move on to the balance of other bills that we've been tracking. There are obviously many other. I'm just going to give you a highlight. I'm not going to go through these bills. I'm just going to touch on them. And if you have any questions about any of them, just let me know. But I'll move through them very quickly. So the first one, 2405, was just an alternative way to fund commercial energy efficiency within the state. We've been neutral on that. Initially, the counties had some issues with it, but I think they've changed that a little bit. So it takes some of the burden off the counties, I understand. The Clean Energy Transition Act Reliability Study, that is the Senate Bill 6135. That's the Senator Sheldon bill. I think you're going to see it leans heavily on the work that Greg talked about, likely on the resource adequacy. A strong support across the utilities and across the aisle. The Community Solar Bill has changed dramatically over the session, and it's been changing again, and we've been supporting the bill lately and been neutral on this bill. We'll see how that comes out here in the next day or two as it, again, just like the bill Tracy's talking about, continues to be changed. On the human resources and safety side, there's been quite a bit going on at that in that area again this year. So the first two bills are just we've seen these every year, an increase, a one-time increase to the monthly amount for the PERS and TERS retirees. The paid family medical leave, there's some fixes that are mainly technical. There is one section there that we're working with Lorna to see if we can change a definition that would reduce some of the burden to employers. Unemployment benefits, it's just changing a little bit of that language to that particular law. We've been concerned, but I think that's been changed, and we may be moving less concerned on that one. The industrial insurance medical exams, we were opposed to that initially, but there's been changes to that in the last couple of days, moving us more to neutral, maybe with some concerns. But the issue that was causing problems now going to be dealt with by a work group to determine how to move forward. The 2490, there's a provision that we're still opposed to, and there's some ongoing efforts to try and change a new section that was added to that in the last committee. General government issues, the 2588, we're neutral now, but we were opposed to a previous language on this, but based on testimony in the Senate local government, they actually switched based on testimony and put their bill back in, and we're all pretty good with the Senate version of this bill now. Waiving connection fees, we were concerned when I wrote this, but again, it changed over the weekend, and now the bill has been to apply to only counties with over 1.5 million residents. So no longer an issue for Chelan. whole attachments. We were opposed, but this was, again, a bill that was introduced by Richard DeVolt, representative from Chehalis. He is now retiring. I think it was his last act on this issue. But the point is, we'll likely see this thing back again, but it's not going to go anywhere. It was dead, but it had a hearing, and it's still dead.
Sean,
yes.
Back up to 2629.
Correct, yes.
How many counties have more than 1.5 million people?
I do not know the answer, but this was based on a need for King County, an issue in Kirkland. And so they may be it. I'm not really sure if Snohomish, I doubt Snohomish County is even that large.
Is there a concern that the fact that we had concerns with it, that once it's passed for one county, it makes it easier to go back for the second bite of the apple in a year or two and include all the counties?
I think not in this case. There's quite a bit of opposition to what they were trying to, how it was being pursued. Not necessarily what was being done, but it was mainly around water issues in this case. And it's settled, and it's taken care of the need that was being addressed by doing that. Okay. So I don't know. I don't believe we're going to see that scope creep. The commissioner pay adjustments, you know about that one. That would just bump it out. Every 5 years, it'll go from July to January to line up with others. The blockchain work group, we actually got a change of that to include PUDs on this work group. And so that's moving forward. And the dig law updates, just some technical, and we've been supportive of that all along. And that's moving forward. This other one was a chloropyrifos. Try to make sure I got that right. It's a pesticide. The concern would be that...
Trade name of Lors Ban.
I'm sorry.
Sure. Another name is Lors Ban.
Okay.
We know it well.
So the concern is how they would set some contaminant levels, and so the concern is how that's going to be done. Broadband office funding. We've been successful. This has been a big push by WAPUTA and members of WAPUTA to increase that for the director who was brought in last year. Now it would increase his funding to a level we think would help him do his job properly and actually benefit the state. The Forest Health, this is the Commissioner Fran's proposal. It's part of the budget discussions, but as Tracy just talking, well, it continue to be part of those conversations right now, or will it be one of the ones that falls out of this process? There's also the Senate proposal to bond for Forest Health, and we've seen that again. Well, we see that based on budget conversations. And finally, the Green Transportation Capital Grant Program is a project that Link has a project related to nexus to what Chelan PUD would be for charging their buses at the main station. And it's the last one on the budget, but on the list. And if they get a fully funded budget, then they could do this. But the Senate or the House, the Senate did not include the budget funding this year. They bumped it out to the next biennium, but the House had it in their budget. So we've been working to see if we can get that included in the final budget out of the legislature.
It's actually a fairly important one. We'll probably be bringing Richard Rock in to come and talk to the board about this. There's a lot going on in this area, and our team has been very involved with them in terms of trying to help them get to greater use of electric charging for buses.
So we've been meeting with our delegation to do what they can to help make sure that funding stays in the budgets. Just some bills of note that died. We had the disclosure to electric customers. We did not like this bill. It had pretty wide support to kill it, and it did not make it past its out of its house. The building electrification building bills, energy code delay, and generator reimbursement, use of reimbursement, all those did not pass. And now we're dead for this biennium. Questions?
Just a comment. Just looked it up. Snohomish and Pierce County, 2017 census, a little over 800,000. So probably King County alone.
Yeah, it's not uncommon to have, we've seen legislation for cities over 750,000.
Yeah.
Seattle. So we do see that from time to time.
Yeah. So a little update. There was an amendment offered. It was voted on and passed, and then they recognized it was the wrong amendment. So then they offered up the next amendment. It passed. and then the chair appears to have some confusion, so it's put on hold till Wednesday. They're still trying to get it. Anyway, just more sausage making. So, we don't know yet.
Some of us really like sausage.
That's good.
Thanks, guys.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, we're through the morning agenda. I'd like to suggest that we try to take some of the afternoon items. We have a couple of, probably, in fact, four manager items I'd like to talk about. Thought maybe we'd go to that next, and we may even get to commission travel this morning, is depending on how we do here. So I'd like to start with an update on the repairs to the Puget Sound transmission lines. Kirk Hudson's going to give that report.
Steve, while we're doing that, is it unlikely we're going to have an executive session?
We do not have an executive session planned for today.
Okay.
Good morning. Kirk Hudson, Managing Director of Generation and Transmission. Just wanted to update you on the McKenzie-Beverly line repairs on the west side. We reported either late January or early February that there was extensive damage on the west side, which, just a reminder, that's kind of our alternative if we lose power around the Plain, Lake Wenatchee, Coles Corner area. We backfeed from the west side, and so we wanted the board to be aware and the public to be aware that there were outages up in that part of our service territory. They'd be longer than normal because of that loss on the west side. We reported earlier those repairs were scheduled to be done throughout the month of February, and good news, happy to report Puget Sound Energy has made restoration on the west side as of somewhere around February 20th. So we're back to our normal configuration. Should we have outages, we have that backfeed capability into that part of our service territory. Yeah, great news. It was a lot of damage from my understanding. A lot of trees came down across into the lines and across the highway. You might remember that was around January 10th time frame where the pass was closed for a while.
Since that's the route to my grandkids' house, we've been over it a few times, and yeah, there was a lot of damage.
Yeah. Thank you.
Wanted to report, we had a conversation about Sahikan about a month or so ago, and the board had suggested that we schedule two public meetings, one in March, knowing that there might not be much of a turnout, but still the people who live there care a lot about this, and then one later in probably the May-June timeframe. So we have scheduled that March meeting. It's March 26th. We have made arrangements for a boat. One of our contractors is making a boat available. Take our staff up to Steakin. They'll be leaving Mill Bay and Manson at 8:30. I know that Commissioners Congdon and McKenna had expressed interest in participating in that. So that's, I want to make sure that you're aware of that. If we went beyond that, of course, we'd have to call a special meeting. So unless I hear otherwise, we won't be planning to call a special meeting at this time. And the expectation is that they will leave and be back by about 5 or so. So I certainly want to be back before it gets dark or rough out there. So that's the plan right now.
That was my only question, is if we were coming back.
Yep.
Yeah, we'll leave you there.
Well, usually I'd say that would be good, but at this time I needed to get back.
Well, we'll be back in May for the other meeting. Right?
Steve, this is Ann.
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Hear you well.
Yeah, I was just curious, how big a boat is it that we're going up in?
The information I have doesn't tell me that. Enough to be able to take our staff and supplies up to Steakin, and assuming that you would be there as part of it.
It's a big, it's a fairly big size boat.
It's a Forest Service boat.
Pilgrim Boat Company is all I know.
I think it should be our boat. It's not our boat.
No, this is a contractor's boat. Oh, it's actually bigger than our boat, as I understand it. So it's called Pilgrim Boat Company.
Okay, just curious.
40 cubits
you can't get strong winds. Mm-hmm. You can get real strong winds that time of year, so I was just curious.
Yeah, it's what we use. So when we need to take staff up there, particularly if there's emergency restoration or something like that, so mm-hmm. assumption is that it's strong enough to be able to withstand wind and wave.
Yep. Okay. Good. Thanks.
Two other things. One, we did file comments last Friday in the California ISO proceeding on governance. Took a fairly strong position, joined with, we endorsed the comments of the public generating pool, which went through issue by issue about the ways that the California governance structure could have a significant influence on decision making by the CAISO. And what the fixes that would need to be put in place in order to make sure that that wasn't a risk for those of us that reside outside of California. There were quite a few comments filed. I think there were about a dozen comments that were filed by a variety of parties. And there's a public hearing on that coming up in the next 2 weeks to talk about it. So just keeping you informed that we told you that we would be making those comments, and we have filed them. Would also like to take a moment just to say that we are getting ready to issue a notice to all employees with respect to coronavirus. So pretty basic information that we've gleaned from the local health agency. I won't necessarily go through that. But the big thing that we will be doing is encouraging people to avoid all non-essential travel. And that's a tough term because we send people places to do important stuff. I don't want to leave the impression that people are traveling just for the fun of it. I was taking a look at what's scheduled in terms of travel in the next couple of weeks, and there's a lot of technical conferences, a lot of opportunities for people to grow their skills. We've talked a lot about the importance of employees here doing individual development plans and getting prepared for the fact that there's a lot of change going on in our industry, and being knowledgeable about that, being able to take advantage of technology change in particular. Having said that, we also very concerned about that we provide an essential service, and we want to minimize the risk of infection getting into our community here at the PUD because we're not very deep, and if we had a significant problem, we could have difficulty carrying out some of our fundamental duties. We've talked a lot with local health agencies. I'd say a key piece that influenced me with respect to this decision is that essentially what happens with a contagion like this is that you would expect it to peak fairly rapidly and at a fairly high level. And what you're trying to do by reducing the interactions that people have with others is both to delay its onset and to reduce the size of the peak. And I think that those both make sense in terms of particularly the functions that we carry out here and the importance of those functions. So it may cost us some money, to be honest. People may have travel that on non-reimbursable fees. We're going to try and minimize that, obviously, and get a hold of all the folks that fees have been paid to and see if we can get reductions in those. But we will be substantially reducing the amount of travel of PUD employees. Wanted to make you aware of that. That notice will be, like I say, going out sometime probably within the next hour or two. Those are my items in terms of manager items. Any questions?
Just on a personal note, I think that's a wise decision, and I'm supportive of that. Realize that does impact, but I think in the long run, safety and protecting core business attributes is important, and I think that's a good decision.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I thought maybe we would pick up a couple things. We have a commission item, a mid-sea meeting proposed motion we might be able to capture, and then we would move to commission travel after that.
Okay.
I would move that we set a special meeting on Monday, March 9, 2020 at 5:30 p.m. at Wild River Sports Bar and Grill, 560 Valley Mall Parkway, East Wenatchee, for the purpose of holding a mid-sea general managers and commissioners meeting.
Second. Any discussion? All those in favor of the motion?
Aye.
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 Against? Motion passed.
Okay. And if we could have just one moment, we're getting Lisa to come in.
Could I offer just something under commission items? I know Commissioner Arsenault and I spent most of last week in Washington, D.C. with the PUD Association. And just for our fellow commissioners' edification, we had meetings with most of the congressional offices, I believe all the congressional offices, and we hit at a moment in time that there was absolutely intense interest in what was going on with the biological opinion regarding the Snake River dams here in the Pacific Northwest. And as we all know, we have a resolution on record that we passed supporting the maintenance of those dams, and there appears to be a high level of intense conversation about a variety of varying approaches to how we manage that. But for those that I think everybody's seen, that the biological opinion did come out, and the recommendation is supportive of a modified approach to operating the dams but maintaining them. And so maybe the most intense week I've ever had back there during the APPA fly-in, the members were fully engaged. So it was a time well spent for Commissioner Arsenault and I.
Thank you.
You know, I actually would just add one other thing that because I was in D.C. with the commissioners last week and had some other meetings, and one thing that I haven't reported to you on before is that the U.S. entity has scheduled another round of negotiations now with the Canadians for the middle of March. Recall that it had been expected that at this next round the U.S. would put a proposal on the table. It appears that that's likely to happen, although can't say it for certain. This could be a fairly critical meeting in terms of the overall negotiations. With that, I would like to invite Lisa Sanders to come up and talk about commission travel.
Early today. Mm-hmm. Good job. Okay, so for March, we have Commissioner Congdon canceled her NWPPA trip to Reno. We have Waputa in Olympia, Commissioners Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith traveling for that. April, Waputa in Olympia, Commissioners Congdon and Smith attending that. April 22nd, Commissioner McKenna for Energy Northwest. In May, we have Waputa at Spokane Davenport for, I believe, only Commissioner Arsenault is attending. Anyone else? Nope. NWPPA, May 17 to 20 in Kennewick. I have Commissioners Arsenault, Congdon, and McKenna traveling for that. Sound good? Mm-hmm. Sounds good. For APPA National Conference in June in Long Beach, I have Commissioner Arsenault, McKenna, and Smith traveling for that. Commissioner Congdon and Bowles won't be attending. The June 25 Waputa Water Committee meeting, does anyone besides Commissioner Congdon plan to go? For July Waputa meetings, I'm not sure of the location yet. I have Commissioners Arsenault Bowles attending.
Yes.
Okay. July 20 to 23, the APPA policymakers. I know Commissioner Smith plans to attend. I'm not sure about anyone else.
I don't think so.
Okay. Then we have Commissioner McKenna in Tri-Cities for Energy Northwest again, July 29th. Then September, Waputa, I'm not sure where that is either. Going to skip to the October Budget Committee meeting. I have rooms held there. And does everyone go to this?
Not normally. Normally, Commissioner Arsenault, as a committee chair, would go. I would go as an executive committee member. That would be the normal. Yeah.
Okay. Everyone else willing to drop off of there? Yes? Yes? Okay.
No, I won't go.
All right. I think we're pretty far ahead. I'm going to skip to and we have Commissioner Arsenault has flight credit now, and also Alaska has gifted him a $75 credit for some travel mishap. I haven't heard about that yet.
It happened to three of us last week. Four hours extra in SeaTac. So,
oh
yeah.
Well, I only have one of these credits.
Mine came to me. I don't know if you got one.
I got it.
Yeah.
I didn't know.
Anyway, on the list of things to keep track of and use up later, and have everyone's returned expense report for January. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you'd like to cover?
Lisa, I will be making some changes to my APPA conference in L.A. in terms of the dates, but there's no need to make those changes just yet. I will be getting back to you with all the information.
Okay. Anything else?
Thank you, Lisa.
Thank you.
Just cover one other quick item, delegation of action items. We had none from the last board meeting, but in the board workshop, something just got raised, kind of a sidebar about looking at surplus county properties and confirming if they would be viable for substations. We are having that conversation. We're not quite ready to report on it yet, so I just wanted to acknowledge that we've got that one on the list, and we'll be getting back to you. My guess is by the next meeting. And with that, we are out of items to deal with this morning, and we don't have our folks here to do the resolutions. They won't be here until 1 o'clock.
Okay. All right. So at this time, we will, what's the term I'm looking for? Recess for lunch, and we'll be back at 1 o'clock.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the March 2nd, 2020 business session of the Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. I'd like to remind everyone to please silence your cell phones and any other electronic devices. Welcome all of our visitors today. We place great value on the public's input in our meetings. And since these meetings are recorded, if you have any item on the agenda that you'd like to address, we ask that you come to the microphone. Please state your name and address for the record, and please limit your comments to 3 minutes. We will move first into our business topics. The first one is our consent agenda. Commissioners, we have a consent agenda in front of us, which includes item number 9.
Move approval of the consent agenda with the inclusion of resolution 9.
Second.
Any discussion on any item? Those in favor of the consent agenda, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Consent agenda is approved. motion's carried. Okay, we're in back into the regular agenda at this point, and Steve, help remind me where we're at.
We would be on agenda item 10, and this is a resolution approving advertisement of bids for Rock Island Dam Spillway Pier 1 repairs, bid number 19-83, and authorizing the general manager of the district to publish notice inviting sealed proposals for said project. Brett Bickford will be presenting.
Good morning, Brett Bickford, Director of Engineering and Project Management. The primary objective of this bid is to repair the concrete that's been overstressed at the Rock Island Spillway Pier Number 1. And this is a photo looking south along the pier with a highlighted area showing Pier 1. The cause of the overstress, we believe, is related to very slow growth of the concrete due to what is called alkali silica reaction, or ASR. That might be a term that you've heard or maybe not. It's a chemical reaction between the alkaline cement paste and silica that's in the aggregate. This is a known phenomenon at Rock Island. Other large concrete structures in the United States associated with hydropower, some of them have this issue as well. What has happened with the slow growth in the concrete as it's caused some of the expansion joints that we have in the deck to close and grow together? So as we have thermal cycling, summertime temperatures, these two pieces that have closed up at the joint are now putting stress on each other. And because it's right at the corner where the spillway meets the powerhouse one, we're seeing that that stress is pushing out on this pier number one. And so what the scope of the contract is to go in and to restore those expansion joints. So we'll do concrete cutting. That'll leave us about another 2-inch gap so we can have time for the concrete to continue to grow. We can have expansion and contraction capability. And then to restore the strength here, we will drill through where we've seen some overstressed concrete, and we'll put in tendons and rods, and we will grout those, and we will tension them. The second objective of our project is to use the equipment that it's going to take to get in here and do the work and do other inspections. It's quite difficult to get under the deck there to see without limiting spillway capability and things like that. So we're going to have in this contract the ability to go inspect, and then provisions if we find some other things that we should be repairing while we're there, we can do that at the same time. Since identifying this overstress in the fall of 2000, the district's performed very detailed inspections of this area. We worked with some consulting engineers to do some analysis, and we installed some crack monitoring equipment. Right in the upper corner here, you can kind of see some yellow and black striped items, and we've put those in there to monitor concrete movement. And so we've been watching that since 2008. We've decided what we want to do is limit operating the gantry crane that's seen there in the background in that area until we do this repair. We've had the district's dam safety consultant review our findings and analysis. And there's not any immediate concern to dam safety from them. And we've also submitted all of our information to FERC, and we're keeping them apprised of our inspections and our repair schedule. Is there any questions?
All right. Thank you, Brett.
Yep, you're welcome.
Appreciate that.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Never knew concrete could grow.
Yep. If you look in the sidewalks, you'll see those little expansion joints. So, yeah, in the summer when it's warm, concrete can grow quite a bit, and it'll freeze in the wintertime, shrink up. Yep.
All right. All right. Thank you very much.
Next up will be agenda 11. Brett will be staying for this. Resolution rejecting all bids and declaring that no bids were received for Rocky Reach C2 through 7, Wicket Gate Servo Motor Refurbishment, bid number 20-05, and authorizing the Rocky Reach C2 to C7 Wicket Gate Servo Motor Refurbishment be obtained by negotiation. Brett, it's up to you again.
Yes, on last Thursday, we opened bids for this work, and we received two bids. One from Voith Hydro, the other from Andritz Hydro. the bid from Voith. Unfortunately, they took exception to one of our major specifications on how to do a particular repair to the cylinders. And so we weren't able to award to them based on that material exception. They had the lowest price. Our second bidder had a price that was greater than 15% above the engineer's estimate. So by state law, we can't award for that. Both of them, so we did some discussions, had some discussions with Voith. And so why didn't they conform? And they said that the process that we specified in our bid, which is how the cylinders are originally made, is something that's not readily available for manufacturers like them to do. It's kind of a process that, kind of like in a new factory, like a new car coating. They can do it a certain way. After that, you get what you, when you take it to a body repair shop, different type of method to repair it. Andritz recognized that too, and they put an alternate in their bid for the other method that Voith proposed, but their alternate was still greater than the engineer's estimate. We think it's best to talk with both of those companies further and maybe try to find others and negotiate which process we should try to use to get these cylinders repaired. This was a contract that we were proposing as a contingency to do work as we are working on our turbine bushing replacements on units 2 through 7. We've got those servos removed from unit 2, and over the weekend we actually identified that they have some major scoring that we want to repair. And so this contract, now it's critical that we can get something in place so that we can help support our crews in getting that work done and those units returned to service as soon as possible.
Any further questions for Brett?
No.
Okay.
Thank you.
We have...
I think we're ready for a motion. I would just like to check. I know we had a little difficulty getting Commissioner Arsenault back on the phone. Just want to see if both Commissioner Arsenault and Congdon are on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
I'm here.
Okay, then we're ready for sure.
Okay, so we have two resolutions, 10 and 11. We have a motion.
Yeah, I move that we accept resolutions 10 and 11 as presented.
I'll second that.
I'll second.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any further discussion on these two agenda items? Giving that said, those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion passes. Steve, did we have anything left on manager items?
No, we don't. And we also, we did go through delegation of action items, and we do not have any new action items from today's meeting that we recall, at least.
Okay. We've finished up commission travel, and delegation of items for today.
We did not capture any.
Okay. All right. At this time, we're open to additional public comment. Is there anybody from the public that would like to address the commission this afternoon? Yes, sir. Please come forward and state your name and address and speak into the microphone.
My name is Charles Follis. I live in Eniat, 2027 Lakeshore Drive. In 1977, I purchased a house on the waterfront. My title insurance says that I own to the middle of the old highway. Well, evidently, the PUD owned it. And my insurance company said I owned it. And I bought some land from the PUD where my house is. I didn't have enough room to park my house on the north side. So I went to the PUD, and they, Bob McDougall, come down and join it. He put that one piece up for auction. I happened to win the auction. And then when I got it paid for, they're triangle lots. They're there. You can't put nothing on it. So I tried to buy the land that would be east of that to square them land off. And so I got a letter here, and Tim Larson, he wrote me. He says, I have reviewed your land purchase request, and then it goes on to say they're not able to do it now. So then I get a, he called me back in, I think it's later, about 4 years later, and he wants me to, he's okay to purchase that land. Well, he's got the land north of my house, but he also, he's got in there my front yard. He wants $20,000 for my front yard. And I told him, I says, you know, I want the land north of my house, but I'm not going to pay for that land until I find out what my insurance company says. I have title insurance. So that goes on for 4 or 5 years. And I get a, I finally tell the, told my attorney, I says, just settle with him. I'll get the $20,000 to pay for my front yard. And so evidently there was a letter sent to the PUD telling them that Fallis's have closured the deal. So I get a letter, I get this letter in the mail from the insurance company, and it's got a copy of the check, but I don't have the check. And I get that like on Tuesday. Well, on Friday, Steve Cruitt calls me and says, Chuck, you want to come and sign that? And me and Tim Lamb, we had an argument about when I was going to pay that. And I said, I'm not going to pay that till I get the check. So Steve Cruitt called me on that Friday after I got that check. And he says, Fallis, you coming in to sign that contract? I says, no, I told you I wasn't. I got the check the next Thursday. Called up Steve Vaughn. I got that check. Well, things are different now, Chuck. And so I come here, and I think I talked to you and you, Randy Smith, and because we've been paying taxes on since 1962. I paid taxes on it for 40-some years. You go to the auditor, you can't get your money back. You got to sue the city. So anyways, since that time, let's see what else will come up. I come up and seen this, and you took me out to... You come out to my house the next morning at 8 o'clock in the morning, remember? And you, it was Randy Smith. Are you Randy Smith?
There is another Randy Smith. That would, if you came down here, I've never met you. I have to apologize.
You went down there, and you guys changed all the taxes on that.
There was a different Randy Smith, I believe. Yeah, it wasn't me.
It was one guy, because I was coming to a meeting like this, and he come over there and talked to me. And I looked at you, and I didn't look like you because he was a younger guy. But anyway, if you can find out who it is, go to the tax and see who changed it. Yeah. Here, I've been paying taxes on that for 40-some years. And in 2 weeks, he got... In fact, everybody on that thing is paying taxes on that. And then two or three years ago, they took the taxes off. And so my deal is I can't sleep at night. The way you guys have treated me on that thing, I think, let me finish. After they turned me down, the PUD called the city. They wanted to exchange some of that land. The reason why they canceled on me. So now they put up a $60,000 shed for the city because they exchanged the land. You built that thing, and that thing is... I look right out my backyard, and there that shed is right there. I look out from my top window, and look at that shed. And I just don't. And then I called him, and I told him about this thing, and he says, I'll check into it. I never got a call from him. He says he don't remember it, but I did. I read about him, how the good things he does for this for the CUD, and he says, and I'm still waiting for that call. But I can't sleep at night. I went to bed last night about 11 o'clock, 3 o'clock. I couldn't sleep, so I just got up. And that's the way it goes. I've stayed up till 5 o'clock in the morning thinking about how I got... you don't know. I'm 88 years old. I don't need this kind of stuff. I've been in business in Indiana for 60. And if your word ain't no good, you ain't no good. It's the way I believe. It's the way I've been taught. And them guys... I don't understand, like Tim Larson, he was, and I don't know why Steve Cruitt, or no, not Steve, Steve Vaughn, did that to me. And I think it was the higher-ups that replaced Tim Larson. They went to the, I went to the council when this, they was trying to change the land. And they had the gal, I don't know what, who replaced Tim Larson. I went, and I tried to get them not to change it. Well, two of them didn't vote to change it, but they changed it. They've got the, you've got your shed up there. And I think about, where's the truth at anymore? Where is it? Where is it a guy's word any good? I mean, that's my problem. I just, now they want to, PUD's come back with another contract to buy that land, and I just tell them, I think I'm going to tell them to go, I'm not going to be here another 5 years. So why should I have to worry about sleeping at night or thinking about what happened to me? I just, and so that's my problem.
So let me just say, I apologize for.
And I called him. I did call you. And I told you all about it, and you said, I'll check into it, and I'll give you a call back. But I never have got a phone call yet.
So apologize for not getting back to you. I'm generally aware of the issue, but not specifically aware, so I'm not really able to respond right now in terms of what the status is. I know people have been working to resolve. There's a whole set of issues there.
Eric, your attorney, he's come up with another solution, but I'm just tired of it. It's not what I originally had. They shortened the land. They took the price down a little bit, but I just.
So what I'd like to do is have an opportunity to go review the record and see where we are and get back with you, with our staff. We'll set up a meeting as soon as I get a chance to get an understanding of the issue, yeah. And then sit down and talk about where we're at. And
well, it's not only my problem. There's about four more houses.
Yep. I'm familiar.
The guy next door to me, he got a building permit for the city, and his front yard is 1 foot inside his house, his front yard boundary. And we're trying to get with the PUD to get all of them lined up, but every one of them houses, or the boundaries are off. Yeah, well, what happened, the insurance company said they got the right-of-way of the old highway. Well, the city before that bought it from the Harris's. So
we need to resolve this issue. There is an issue that's been a long-standing issue up there, and I thought we were making progress towards getting it resolved. I'm hearing that we're not making as much progress as maybe we thought.
I mean, my neighbor, Dustin, here he's, his boundary line's inside of his front room. You guys own the land. I mean, you guys could just say, hey, give us to the middle of the road. They'd be satisfied with that. But
well, Charles, thanks for coming speaking to us.
May I ask a question, please?
Dennis.
If just so I'm clear in my mind, if you could be king for a day.
Pardon?
Just in my mind, to help me, if you could be king for a day, what is it you would like to have done?
Well, one thing, I'd like to have that shed that you guys give to the city, take it out of my... I used to be able to see Mission Ridge. I built a garage, put apartments on it. I don't see it anymore. Then I used to look out my window upstairs. I used the computer and look out and I could see the Columbia River. I can't see it anymore. I can see around the shed, but it's just... And then there's two double wides up there. Look down there, and that's looking right at that shed. Why did you put it there? I wish all of you would go up and look at it and just ask yourself, if you lived there, would you want that shed there?
So tell me what you'd like done.
Pardon?
Tell me what you'd like done if you could just pick what you'd like.
I know. What I would like is see the council give us to the middle of the road, all the way down. There's about four houses. And like my front yard, it only used to be about 12 or 14 feet from my front porch. I filled all of that in. I put the lawn in it. I put water. I've watered it and mowed it for probably 25 years. Then you guys want me to pay you $20,000 for it. they did come down on the price. They wanted $10,000 for that other thing, and they wanted $20,000. They took $10,000 off because they was going to make a right-of-way there. And then when all this was done, I asked Steve Cruitt, I says, what do you guys need an easement for there? And he says, oh, for our equipment to come through. And I asked Tim Larson the same question. Well, when they decided not to sell it to me, they come out with another map where they're going to put a walkway through for people to walk through there. It was never brought up in the subject, but that's another thing we're fighting. I mean, the city, you guys build a nice walkway from the park, clean north about a mile. It goes right alongside the road, then it goes alongside the river. Then it goes that way, it goes up to the Eniac Bridge, goes under the bridge, goes up about a quarter of a mile, then goes down a mile, then goes across the road. So why do you need that four houses to be able to walk from the park? That's all we're going to do is get the beer cans or dog poop or whatever for people walking through there. And you got a nice paved walkway you put up there right on the highway, right on the Lakeshore Drive.
Charles, is there anything else that you wanted to respond to Dennis's question?
I'm sure that was Randy Smith because he come out to my house at 8 o'clock. He's a tall, thin guy.
That ain't me.
Yeah, I seen that you didn't have a hat. Well, he had a hat on, so I could. Well, but he, you know, we paid taxes on that for 40 some years. In 2 weeks, he had all the names taken off.
Charles, thanks for visiting with us today.
Sorry, I hope I didn't interrupt any of you guys.
No,
not at all.
Okay, do we have any other public comment today? Let's see. So, any other general matters to come before the commission today? Anybody else? All right. No executive session at this point. No. You're making my job easy today. So with that, we are adjourned.